This is Scripture Read Badly,
a podcast where two grown-up pastors' kids discuss the stories of the Bible in chronological order,
attempting to avoid heresy and generally having a good time.
I'm Jeremy.
And I'm Ryan.
Sit back and rejoice. Today's verse comes from 1 Samuel chapter 18, verses 12 and 29. Saul was afraid of David because the Lord was with him but had departed from Saul. And 29, Saul was even more afraid of David. So Saul was David's enemy continually. Usually it's men who fear or dislike their mothers-in-law. But this is a father-in-law being afraid of his son-in-law, which is very strange. It's like a different comic book. Someone should write a comic book of this, where every time Saul walks into the room and sees David, he's like, oh no, and like dances and runs around and tries to get away from him. This is Scripture Read Badly, and I'm Jeremy, and I will be coughing a little bit through this episode, so excuse that.
My name is Ryan, and I shouldn't be coughing throughout this episode unless I accidentally inhale water, which I'm wont to do from time to time.
Oh, very true.
I don't like doing it, but I find myself inhaling water far more than I would expect myself to have to go through that. Today, we are going to be talking about 1 Samuel chapter 18, and this is on the heels, on the very large heels of David and Goliath.
Huge heels.
Yep. From the last episode, we know that David had just hit Goliath in the forehead, with a stone, then rushed over to him and chopped off his head with his giant sword. And then the Philistines ran away, and all of them got killed. Or those that got away spread the fear of Israel throughout their land. So that was a pretty great victory and very significant moment in David's life, because up to this point, we know that he was a shepherd for his father, but also a lyrebird for his king, for King Saul. He would play his lyre when Saul was distressed.
He would lyre. he would whole big lyring.
Yep.
And he probably won some awards at some local fates for his best kept sheep and his best braided back hair sheep. That's probably not the technical term for its back hair, but...
And he probably won a certificate as well as a $50 note for his lyre playing at an Estedford.
Ah, true.
Yep.
The lyre, it wouldn't be the rock Estedford, the folk Estedford. And you'd have backup dancers. That's how he met Jonathan first.
Jeremy, right before we get stuck into this story, I have a quick Estedford story, if you wouldn't mind me telling it.
Yes, please.
All right.
Not at all.
When I was 14 years old, no, I was 15 years old. My brother was in year 12. I was in year 10. My brother and his friends formed a rock band for a local Estedford music competition. And they needed a keyboardist, so I joined the band. It was my first band that I was ever part of, and it was called Halfway Up. We entered with the song I'm a Believer by the Monkees.
Nice.
Kind of doing a cover of Smash Mouth's cover of that song. And we entered into the non-classical competition of this music Estedford. And we were up against our local rival school's entire orchestra band, who was doing an extremely slow rendition of As Time Goes By. And I remember going out onto that stage, we had a couple of hiccups with our amps and stuff.
Classic.
And the adjudicators were very gracious and said, "It's all right, you can start the song again, this time with the guitar plugged in and turned up." And so we played the song and they said, "All right, that's very good. Thank you." And then 30 kids with their instruments came out on stage and played As Time Goes By. We ended up beating our rival school's orchestra.
Yeah.
By a few points. But it was relatively close. I think they said something like their music was great, but halfway up showed enthusiasm and excitement, and that helped their music feel better to listen to. So yep. Then we ended up being given one certificate as well as one $50 note as our prize. And what ended up happening was the guitarist in our band photocopied that $50 note and gave us each a copy of the $50 note, and then gave that $50 note to his mum, because his mum drove him and a lot of us to our band practices. So his mum got a little bit of money for Petty, because she had to drive a long way to take her son to band practices.
What a great mum.
I know.
Shout out to mums everywhere.
Good on your mums.
I just Googled it, and the Rock of Stedford doesn't exist anymore.
Oh.
It stopped in 2012. That's so sad.
There you go. Well, this would have been in 2009.
Also, when I Googled a Stedford, the weirdest word ever. A Stedford. How do you spell that? There's like four E's. Anyway.
I think I know this.
18.
It's EISTEDDFOD.
Yeah. Yeah, perfect. Nailed it.
I Stedford.
That's not how I spelt it. No. Not at all.
All right, Jeremy, take us away.
This is the start of one of the greater friendships that the Bible has reported.
Mm-hmm.
Using words like... no, I've forgotten. We're not there yet. We'll get there. But Jonathan ends up saving David's life countless times, and Jonathan also ends up like dedicating his life to David, but then also dies in the process, but that's fine. It says here, was knit to the soul of David, and Jonathan loved him as his own soul.
Wow.
Which is ridiculous in my opinion, but so beautiful. Other than possibly your wife and family, would you describe your love for anyone as your loving them as your own soul?
Not me specifically. I think this type of closeness happens in the military. When you serve together, there's a bond that's formed between you that is closer than family, because you haven't been in the trenches and eating food rations and being in perfect sync with another person to the point of being in a life and death situation as you have with this other person. So I imagine it's some kind of a military bond, as well as probably having interests in common. I imagine they were probably in a band that entered in a Stedford.
Yeah, yeah. Or did some kind of theatre and went on drama camp.
Mm. What instrument do you think Jonathan would have played in David's band?
Some kind of weird trumpet with no buttons. Like a vuvuzela.
Yeah.
And at first David was like, I hate this. And then after a while he was like, all right, this is okay. You can drone along in the background.
Could you imagine if you could kind of hum through a vuvuzela like you do through a kazoo? It'd be like a bass kazoo. That would be amazing.
That would be amazing, especially behind some sweet lyre.
Yes.
And then it's like bling, ba-da-ding, ding, bling. Perfect. Good job, David and Jonathan.
Great. Mm-hmm. Musical duo.
And... at the same time, Jonathan made a covenant with David because he loved him as his own soul. So it's not even just that they've been through cool stuff together, but they actually speak out loud a commitment to each other.
Mm-hmm.
And Jonathan stripped himself of the robe that was on him and gave it to David, and his armor, and even his sword, and his bow, and his belt. And so he's taking off all of his clothes and giving them to David. I wonder if that's because David only shopped at like Clint's Crazy Bargains, and Jonathan was like, you need some better clothes, champ, to be my friend.
David probably went out there in a Hawaiian shirt from Lowe's.
True. Yep. And like footy shorts.
Yeah.
Jonathan was not into that.
No, no. Well, I take this to be a symbolic act on behalf of Jonathan, him saying, you are more deserving of a position of royalty than I am, because I did not face Goliath like you did. So he's, in a sense, obviously it says that he's made a covenant with him, but he's pledging his allegiance to follow David in a way that I don't think anybody else does. Nobody else strips off their clothes and gives them to David. But I think the significance of him being the prince doing it is like saying, everybody under me must align with my attitude as well, and that is submission towards you.
Yep.
So perhaps the closeness that Jonathan feels with David is the source of... Well, this is undoubtedly the source of Saul's bitterness towards David and eventually fear. And I think that's because Jonathan sees that that Saul sees that not only do the officials of Saul align themselves with David, but Jonathan himself does. So Saul probably thinks, if anybody can, if David could take the crown from me, then I have to be prepared. I have to be ready to kill him or whatever. But perhaps more than that, he sees that David is Jonathan's weakness. And so he's thinking, he's fearing for his son. And maybe that's the source of his fear and jealousy to David. Maybe he thinks Jonathan is going to lay down his birthright, his this mantle to David. So I don't want that to happen.
Maybe. Interesting. And at the same time, I wonder if Saul keeps looking at David like, oh, that was just a fluke. And in this verse it says, and wherever Saul sent him, he was successful. So that Saul set him over the men of war. If he was just like, all right, David, go fight this battle, hoping that he would die. But then he was successful and he was like, oh man, all right, I'll send him to this other battle and hopefully he'll die. But he just kept getting more and more successful. Plus Jonathan, and then plus... and this was good in the sight of all the people and also in the sight of Saul's servants. Like, it's just so probably annoying to Saul that he's no longer this big, awesome war guy. It's more David that everyone loves.
Yeah.
And later in the chapter, it tells you that he knows that God's left him.
Yep. So Saul is being overshadowed by this young upstart who seemingly has the support of every person in Israel. So that it makes sense that he's jealous, but at the same time, I've been in situations where I thought I was really good at something, or maybe on a sports team, I was the best, and then this other person comes along, maybe even a younger person, and they are running circles around me. They're on my team, so it's good, we win, but at the same time, I'm not feeling as accomplished with each game as I used to, and so then I can start to resent this person. Whereas a better way to do it would be in humility to even say, these are areas that I recognize that you're better than me in, can you teach me? But also I recognize that you're strong there, I'm weak there, I am going to I'm going to be over here on this side of the field, and we are going to work together in this.
Yeah.
So Saul's approach was a lot more of the dog with its tail between its legs than it was a person trying to work in tandem with David.
Yeah. And because Saul knew that God was going to take the kingship away from him, and he knew that God had left him, he could have easily responded by like, oh, okay, then let's set up the next king well, or I should probably not covet the kingship because it's not mine anymore. But instead, the whole rest of his life, he like struggles and he frantically grasps at power and tries to collect it more, which was just a pointless and almost unwinnable game.
Was Saul aware that Samuel had anointed David?
I don't think so.
Okay, so...
But I might be wrong.
When Samuel came to Saul and said, God says you are no longer his king, he is going to find a new king. This is potentially months, potentially years later. And David had been anointed. And if he had kept that secret from Saul, which he probably did, because we see throughout the next... five or so chapters, David doesn't want to take the kingship from Saul. He still views Saul as rightfully in his position, whether or not he's there rightfully by God's authority anymore or by man's.
Yeah.
But he still respects him. David wouldn't have wanted to bring it up. And he would have known this whole time that this would be the means by which God established him as the rightful ruler over Israel. So as he is in charge of the army and he's going out to the front lines of all these different places, Saul sending him hoping that he'll get killed or at least not be seen as this mighty hero anymore, he is instead seeing it as God building him up step by step to be the king.
Yeah.
And you have this weird tension here between David and Jonathan's pursuits of the crown. Because if it was up to David and Saul and Jonathan and stuff lived beyond the battle coming up, David most likely would have submitted to Jonathan as the king. But then at the same time, we see here that Jonathan is placing himself below David. So there is just as much likelihood that Jonathan would have insisted that David take his rightful place. And Jonathan probably would have heard from David, if they were as close as it says they were, that David had been anointed by Samuel.
Yep.
So Jonathan is probably in on it, and that's probably why he is willing to follow David and view David as not only his best friend and his confidant, but also his king, his leader. Whereas Saul is resistant to that and probably didn't know where and when this new king was going to come from. Maybe he thought it was going to be a leader of a rival family or from a different tribe or something, which David is from a different tribe, but we see in several paragraphs time, David insists that he's from a lowly family in Bethlehem. So he doesn't want to take the glory from Saul in the form of his firstborn daughter. So Saul didn't know that David was going to be the next king, but he probably assumed that by the point where he started gaining a huge following in Israel.
Yeah.
Okay. So Saul's jealousy of David begins at verse 6. Can you take us through this?
Interesting. It's just a whole bunch of David getting praise and his comeuppance, as it were, if that's a positive word, and Saul watching it from afar. And so as David comes home from a good battle, people came out to, women especially came out to sing and dance and to meet King Saul with tambourines, with songs of joy. But instead of them singing Saul's praises, or it could be neutral, but they sing this line: Saul has struck down his thousands and David has his tens of thousands. And so in one way it is praising Saul, like, oh yeah, Saul has killed a lot of people, yeah. But David has killed more. And so if you weren't jealous of David, you would celebrate that. Like,
absolutely.
If you came back from a tournament and it was like, Ryan scored 50 goals, but Philip scored 150 goals, then both Ryan and Philip would be all about that song because it's true, right?
Right.
But because Saul is listening to this from a insecure, possibly very jealous point, he gets angry. So in verse 8, and Saul was very angry, and this saying displeased him. He said, they have ascribed to David 10,000s, and to me they have ascribed thousands. And what more can he have but the kingdom? So straight away he's thinking, he's either going to take the kingdom from me because of popularity, or maybe this is the man that God sent. And instead of him taking his punishment and being like, oh, cool, this is the guy that's going to replace me, let's champion him, he continues into his own depravity, which goes on and on and on and on until attempted murder. And then throughout this chapter, because when he took out Goliath, one of the prizes was his daughter. Like, did he say that?
Yes, he did.
Yeah. So maybe it's starting to dawn on him too, like, I hate this guy, but he's about to become a part of my family because I promised.
Yeah.
And so then in verse 10, we have this interesting verse. The next day, a harmful spirit from God rushed upon Saul, and he raved within his house while David was playing the lyre, and he tries to throw a spear at David to pin him to the wall, hopefully to kill him, I would assume.
Wait, so Saul was having a rave?
Yeah, he was having a huge rave. There was, like, drum and bass, and there was lights, and everyone was taking some sweet pills that they had made from some plants.
Yep.
That makes them feel nice, and they have to drink a lot of water.
David but was up there on the DJ stand with his lyre.
Oh, ring, yeah. Ding, he's ding, like, ding, bing, 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 and then the bass dropped. And that's when Jonathan comes in with the bass.
Yeah.
The kazoo bass drop.
Yes.
Perfect. And then everyone forgot about it, so that's why we only started getting bass drops in the last 2 decades.
Yeah. Because there was nobody there to call their cousin on the phone and say, "Hello? Yeah, it's me, your cousin, Marvin. You know that new sound you've been looking for? Listen to this."
Oh, poor Marvin. All he wanted was a phone.
I know. Poor guy.
But the interesting sentence. The next day, a harmful spirit from God rushed upon Saul.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we've discussed before that the writers of the Old Testament might be writing it from the position of, well, who else would send a spirit like this? Like, it must have been so different, like black and white. Yep. He was calm and sitting on his throne, and then he just got mad and threw a stick at someone.
Hmm.
And so you think, if it was God, what part of God's character forces someone to try and commit murder?
Mm.
Or is this what Romans sometimes talks about, like his depravity had got to such an extent that God just let him be depraved and throw a stick at someone? And I think that's totally... And even in Romans, it's the language is almost, and God let this happen, or God made this happen, whereas it's more God took his protection away, which is not really actively doing something. So maybe God's not putting this spirit in Saul, but he's allowing this to come out. Or it could be just a language tool to present, that it was otherworldly.
Mm.
That this was the start of a rage that was more than just a little bit perturbed.
Mm-hmm. We did talk about this in chapter 16 when Saul first began to be tormented by a spirit like this. Now, I recall in the New Testament, it talks about how God gave the people over to the gratification of their flesh. And I think that's a similar kind of understanding of these goings on. I think that they are thinking God lets people receive what they want, even though it's not good for them. So
yeah.
I guess it could be something like, I've had instances where when I was younger, sometimes we would have people other than our parents looking after us in the morning, or sometimes we would not even have our parents there. So, for example, have a sleepover, everybody's gone off to work or school the next day, but my friend and I are late getting up. Then, instead of eating something that we know will be remotely good for us for breakfast, we choose to eat M&Ms.
Whoa, delicious with milk?
I think so, yeah. And so that was our decision that we made. If there was somebody there to supervise us, they probably, if they were not necessarily a hands-off person, but somebody that warns people and then lets them do things to teach them a lesson, which is one understanding of how God works in some circumstances, they would say, "Hey, Ryan, you probably shouldn't eat M&Ms for breakfast." And I'd say, "Yeah, I know, but I really want it." And they'd be like, "All right, it's your call." So then I eat M&Ms, and then while we're all excited and on a sugar high, we decide to go to the Oval and kick a ball around. And within 2 minutes, I am almost vomiting because of the sheer amount of artificial colors that I have in my stomach. It's not a pretty sight.
Nope.
And that is an instance where somebody looking after me could say, "All right, I gave you two options. I gave you Vegemite toast or a bag of M&M's, and you chose the M&M's, and so here...
Well, I would never choose the M&M's.
Yeah, I know. I'm giving them to you, and so this is from me. These M&M's are from me. What happens to you will probably be bad.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean I've caused it, but I am, in a sense, allowing you to gratify your flesh.
Yeah.
So in this circumstance, we talked about how Saul was insecure and how he was afraid that the crown would be snatched from him because he knew what he'd done was wrong. By this point, yep. He is aware that God is not with him. So there are times, especially when he sees that God is with David, and when he hears people singing the praises of David, he thinks, God has indeed left me. God is with David, he's not with me. And then that in itself is him focusing on his insecurities. And in a situation like that, it makes sense that he would be overcome with rage and yep. try and kill David. Definitely. Because he chose to focus on his insecurities rather than the securities of God. So this harmful spirit from God is most likely Saul choosing insecurities and having God hand it to him instead of choosing peace and excitement and joy and
yeah.
and that type of thing. So that's probably what it is, as from my opinion.
Yep. Agreed. Yep. And then Saul throws the stick at him twice, so it's not even just a momentary rage.
Pin the spear on David.
And what?
Pin the spear on David.
Like, what's that?
Like pin the tail on the donkey.
Oh, yeah. Maybe. Pin the spear on David.
Maybe he was blindfolded.
And he missed every time.
Yeah.
He was that kid at the party that you were like, oh, I am so sorry, yeah. but that's the face. And then it says Saul was afraid of David because the Lord was with him but had departed from Saul. So this is also a fear of God, not just David, which is interesting. And that'll happen more later. And then Saul is like, get away. Like, just get out of my house. I don't want you to play the stupid liar for me anymore. I just want you out. So he sends him away to become the commander of 1,000, which means that David then collects more praise from the people because he keeps doing good,
mm-hmm.
because God is with him.
Yep.
In fact, it ends with, but all Israel and Judah loved David, for he went out and came in before them.
Yep, that's fantastic. So he was the people's leader. He led the armies. Yep. People saw him go like out and rock. Saw him come back. He was like the rock.
The people's champion.
I have a small question about how David evaded him. Saul was the commander of the armies of Israel before David. He yep. was a renowned fighter, a mm-hmm. warrior. He was potentially one of the most skilled in the entire country.
Mm-hmm.
So him hurling a spear at David was probably more than somebody drunkenly throwing a dart at their friend across the room. Yeah. It was more likely an active attempt on David's life. I wonder if David was on guard around him because he knew that something was off.
Oh, true.
So it could have been while David was playing the lyre, Saul comes in and he's like, I told you to stop playing that near my bedroom. And then he throws it at him. And then David does some kind of an amazing fast dodge because he has the Force or the Holy Spirit or whatever. And then as he says, look, you shouldn't do this, Saul picks it up again and goes to throw it and he ducks around the corner or something. So it could be something like that where the first one catches him off guard, but he has enough spiritual foresight to know that he has to be on guard around him, or God made him miraculously move out of the way, or he confronted Saul, or Saul confronted him, and he was able to anticipate his movements. Which one do you think it was?
Yep. I want to say God just did a superhero move with him.
Sweet.
And it was so freaky, and only Saul saw it, so it freaked him out even more.
That's fantastic. Well, like, we do what? Have the that definitive answers on throw. This podcast, so...
We do, definitive.
Mm-hmm.
That's why it's called Scripture Definitively Read. And then the second half of this chapter, which is pretty much basic, we can just not skip it, but
Breeze
he gives
it.
David his daughter.
Yeah.
And I assume it's not before he sends him away.
Yeah, so he says to David, you can have my daughter Mirab as your wife. Now, I believe when he was stating what the person who defeated Goliath will get, it was something like, have Saul's daughter as their wife. And it was probably assumed that it would be the older one that was not married, like in the case of Leah and Rachel with Jacob in Genesis. So he is here betrothing Mirab to David. But what he doesn't tell David is that... Hang on. So this is where it gets a little bit murky. He says, I'll give it to you for a wife. Be valiant for me. Fight the Lord's battles. Because Saul was thinking, I need to show that I'm on his side and hopefully the Philistines will kill him. But instead, David says, who am I from all my relatives, from my clan in Israel, that I should be the son-in-law to the king? So he's responding in extreme humility, where everybody else would jump at this opportunity and think, I'm not married. Yep. The princess isn't married. Then, yeah, of course, I will say yes. He's responding in humility, but it says, at that time when Mirab, Saul's daughter, should have been given to David, she was instead given to Adriel, the Mehothelite, for a wife.
Ooh, good town.
Yeah, so Mehothelite. Anyway, so instead of being given to David... Saul's like, how about this other guy? So then this other guy becomes the son-in-law to the king. I don't know if we ever hear anything about Adriel again. We probably do at some point in passing, but...
I'm looking it up.
Great. Now it says, Adriel. Saul's daughter Michal loved David. And when they told Saul, and the thing pleased him... Sorry. And they told Saul and the thing pleased him. So he's thinking, okay... Great, so this decision I made to give Mirab away is fine because my other daughter loves David. So that's good. And hopefully, when I give her to him, she'll be my foothold against him. I'll be able to manipulate David through my daughter.
Ooh, nice.
Which is pretty sus and not a great leadership move. So then Saul says to David, you will be my son-in-law. And Saul commands his servants to speak to David in private and say, the king has taken delight in you and his servants love you. Now become the king's son-in-law. So he's manipulating the whole situation because he knows of Michal's love for David.
Yep.
Anything on the Adriel front?
Yeah. This is just a Wikipedia page, but it has pretty good references.
Mm-hmm.
Later in the Bible, it says that Michal brought up the sons of Adriel, which is either they think that it means that she brought his sons up as their own mother, but not their own mother, or that they copied the wrong name down and they actually meant Merab, or that Michal was somehow married to Adriel as well as David. So that's interesting, but apparently it doesn't come up much more. Just okay. That he had 5 sons.
All right. So there's the potential that either Mirab died, and so Michal raised the children, or perhaps Michal had an affair with Adriel and bore sons for him. Okay.
Which would make an interesting side story.
Right.
And then have you got to the bride price yet?
No, we're pretty much at that. So David keeps declining and saying, no, I don't want this to happen. I'm too humble, blah, blah, blah. And people keep insisting that...
Yeah, come on, mate. Just Come on, marry her.
The king is giving you his daughter. His daughter loves you. You clearly love his daughter. What are you waiting for? So maybe David was wary that maybe Saul would use her against him. So he could have he could have cottoned on to everything. So what's his deal with the bride price?
Once again, he sets a bar that he thinks is quite high for David to try and get over.
Yep.
Which is, what, 100 foreskins of the Philistines. Which means that he has to kill 100 Philistines at least and then take their foreskins, which is quite an operation, I've heard.
Yeah, it's graphic.
And it is graphic, but it's also, you have to kind of be, I've forgotten the word, but whatever. And so, and Saul, I expect, is like, hey, he'll probably die trying to do this.
Right.
And then David brings a huge bag full of foreskins and just throws them at the king.
Yep.
Which is pretty funny that David keeps just smashing Saul's attempts at being impossible.
Yeah. Yeah, so that was after Saul had insisted that David marry Michal. He's like, all right, fine, I will. And to please my king, I'm going to do what he says. And, oh, that's a really disturbing and weird bridal price, but I guess I'll go for it. And he does.
He definitely does.
And when he... let me see. He brings the foreskins, which were given in full number. So he got all 100 to Saul. Then Saul is even more afraid of David. And so in Saul's mind, David has perpetually become his enemy. So in that instance, he's thinking, now if I die and Jonathan dies, David will actually be king.
Yep.
Perhaps after Adriel, because Adriel married the older daughter.
Ah, true.
But
and maybe Adriel dies, and that's why she has to raise his 5 sons.
Maybe. Okay, so with that in mind, there is lots of precedence here for why Saul is afraid of David. Not only is mighty warrior, and he has led the armies, and he's a skilled musician, and everybody loves him, but now he is his son-in-law. So now he's actually in line physically for the throne. So if anything happens to Saul and his sons, David's next up. Which is something that I don't think I necessarily realized. And I think that is God's incredible planning, that he made it so David would actually be legitimately in line. Yeah.
Yeah.
Rather than just this outsider that gets a following and then is able to overthrow the king. So David, maybe that's why when he gets the opportunity to kill Saul, maybe that's why he thinks, no, this is still wrong. I'm still trusting God's timing. I'm going to be humble. I'm going to respect my king and everybody around me, because he knows that one way or another, God is going to fulfill the promise of making him king.
Yep.
And he probably doesn't want to be the one to make that happen. And we see in about 7 chapters' time that that actually comes true. It comes in about 10 chapters' time, that actually comes true. He becomes king because of the death of all these people. So, pretty crazy. Saul had a legitimate case against David, but David was just such an upstanding and nice guy that to everybody else it seemed absurd that Saul was trying to kill him.
Yep.
All right. So it says, absurd. It says, then the commanders of the Philistines came out to battle, and as often as they came out, David had more success than all the servants of Saul, so that his name was highly esteemed. So he got a reputation among all of the nations around them as this mighty Lion of Judah, as he would later be called. And that is before he's even king. So you can imagine that the surrounding nations, when David actually becomes king, are even more afraid because he's helming the entire nation, not just the military.
Yeah.
So that's pretty crazy. Now, we are led to believe that Saul still went out to battle, because when it says earlier in the chapter, the women came out singing and dancing to meet Saul and that was as they returned from battle. So Saul was still going with him,
yeah.
And he was kind of fighting out of obligation, but he was being extremely overshadowed. Jeremy, as we are beginning to wrap things up, can you think of any times where you have maybe been overshadowed? I've shared my experiences of being on a sporting team, and I'm sure I can think of some times where I've been in a band with somebody that is a million times better than me at everything.
Oh, yeah.
But can you think of any specific times where you've had to either respond like Saul or in the opposite way to Saul?
Yeah, I've engineered situations like that.
Oh.
Like sometimes when you're leading teams, your job is not to be the star, it's to make your followers stars,
mm-hmm.
or like your students stars. And so there's been heaps of moments where I'm like, whoa, I could do this so much better than them.
Yep.
And then they stumble a little bit and then totally nail it. And I'm like, oh, okay, yeah, no, they did it much better than me.
Yep.
Which is awesome, I think.
Yeah.
That can happen.
That's the the natural and humble way of leadership, I guess. And that can often have parallels within parenting and things.
Yep.
I think Yoda said it best in Star Wars Episode 8, The Last Jedi, when he said, "We are what they grow beyond." Talking about having pupils who grow up to be far stronger than their teachers.
True.
And how that is natural.
That's
and
the dream.
Good. Yep. Great. So that's how Saul should have responded in this situation, but he obviously...
But he didn't.
Did not. Well, in the next chapter, or the next chapter or two, we will have more interactions between Saul and David, and Saul pursuing and trying to kill David for actually fairly legitimate reasons, which yeah. I always thought he was just paranoid. But it turns out there's actually a blood reason for him to be afraid of David. So,
yep,
there you have it. All right. Well, I don't really have any other closing thoughts from this. Jeremy, do you have any closing thoughts or advice for the listeners?
No.
Great. Well, my name is Ryan.
My name's Jeremy.
You can check us out on all the social medias. We are we have them all listed in the episode description. Just click through there. Or in particular, you can check out our Instagram. We have some great little clip reels that go up with each episode to give you a taste of what is to come. And you can even share them with your friends, either on Instagram or on Facebook. They're both there. And with that, I would like to share a blessing. And that blessing is, may your bodies be perfectly balanced with their vitamins and their minerals and
ooh, yeah.
anything else within your bodies. May you have enough. Hang on, just looking at these tablets right here. May you have enough omega 3, 6, and 9 with flax,
ooh,
fish, and borage oils.
Flax?
And may you have enough Gross. Cinnamon. Within your body. Apparently it's good for inflammation.
But not too much.
But not too much.
It'll make you choke and die.
Yep. Just like me choking on my water, which happens from time to time. All right. Well, with that, may your bodies have plenty of vitamins and minerals. Goodbye.